this instead of that, or no subsidies, or cut tax. You know, he can fiddle around with it, but he can't change the system except outside of the Constitution. A constitutional president simply doesn't have the power to do away with the Federal Reserve, I don't believe. And so what's really needed is a constitutional dictator, presumably somebody who marched into Washington at the head of an army and reset the Constitution and then retire. I mean, they did it in the Roman Republic. I don't know why we can't do it here.
Well, it's certainly an interesting thing. I was actually getting to that. What I was going to discuss ran out only about I had about another hour to go, but the whistleblower is something put out by WorldNetDaily.com, and this issue in July is called The Constitution, America's Ultimate Battleground, and it starts out with a letter from Joseph Farah, who runs WorldNetDaily, and quite interesting. He says just about along the same lines that you were just talking about, and just goes down the list of all the things to abolish and so forth. So when I come back here next Monday, we'll start out with that, and we can take this whole issue up again.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay, Tom, well, thank you.
Hey, good night, Tom. Thank you.
Good night, and I'll see you all next Monday evening at 7 o'clock.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us Julie Quest. And Julie is part of the Maple River Educational Coalition, a small group of dedicated citizens in the Minnesota area that have had a profound impact not only on what goes on in Minnesota, but really across America. And Julie and her husband and Senator Bachman and, of course, a few others have really, of course, been on the front lines of this battle to let the American people know that when they talk about No Child Left Behind, they have an entirely different interpretation for those words than the average individual. And, of course, it's been said that there's no more efficient means of confusing people than saying what they want them to hear. But when, of course, you speak, you have different meaning for your words. And when they talk about No Child Left Behind, they really mean, of course, a different agenda. And we're going to be talking this evening about civics training. And, Julie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Stan, for letting me come on.
Well, let's see. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and, of course, maybe about the people you work with, and then we'll get into what's happening, the new civics, as it were.
Right. Well, you know, I'm somebody who's been active in politics for many years, but, you know, I don't have any specific special training, but in politics or government or whatever. A number of people in our group do, however. But what I find has been very valuable is that I feel like as somebody who, you know, is not a doctorate or a PhD or a master's or anything, a highly trained, what I can learn, anybody can learn, and we can pass it on to the average person. And that's what we do in our organization, and it's been really helpful. We put things as much as possible into just a bite-sized kind of common sense approach to things, something, you know, that will tie it into people's own experience, and try not to get too far flung in our language. And we find out that, in our organization, which we've been at this now for, you know, since about, the organization itself since about 1997. I've been involved for quite a bit longer than that in politics, but in this education battle, what we've been able to do is, throughout Minnesota and now much more throughout the country, is let people know some just real easy to understand connections, like for example, you know, the idea of patriotism. What does it mean, you know, to believe in the founding principles of our country? And that's something that everybody, or I should say, you know, most people have strong feelings about, and they believe in, and they want that for their children, they want that for their country, they believe in that for freedom. So we try to tie things back into that understanding. And for myself, you know, I feel like I've gone back to school in a way. I've started to learn for myself what these principles mean, these founding principles mean. And I found that we can pass them on to people that way. And that's what we've tried to do with the Maple River Education Coalition.
Well, you know, that's really so important. You know, most people don't understand the foundations of our freedom. They don't teach the Constitution correctly today. They don't teach the Bill of Rights as a restrictive covenant where the power of the central government was to be restricted by the change of the Constitution. The basic concepts of the Declaration that our freedoms come from God and that governments are instituted among men to ensure or to secure our basic rights, which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And, of course, these are God-given rights. We don't teach that in school anymore. We certainly don't teach the Federalist Papers. We don't teach these things that 50 years ago, everybody knew that we were not a democracy. We were a republic. They knew the difference between them. They knew the dangers of government. They knew the dangers of democracy. And, of course, no patriot would ever say we were a democracy because they understood what Plato had written, that democracies always descend into despotism. But it isn't a tragic that today we never teach that. In fact, increasingly, we're teaching our children about, being good citizens of the world. We've changed the entire thrust as we've, of course, changed the worldview and the attitude, beliefs and feelings, or values, attitudes, beliefs and values of our children. So why don't you pick up the story about what's going on now with civic education?
Okay, well, let me just talk about what's happening here in Minnesota to start off with. We actually were able last legislative session, which ended at the end of May in this year, we were able to throw out the federal curriculum, and we're really the first state that's been able to do that. Now it's a pretty big deal. Now it's not the end of the story. Obviously, that's just the beginning of the story because you can only go so far as one state. And what we did is it goes back to our efforts to focus on making our federal education system is called the Profile of Learning, and in every state it's called something a little bit different. And it is, as you mentioned earlier, enforced by No Child Left Behind, and before that it was Goals 2000, and it says
mastery learning and right.
Yeah.
They always have they use all these terms, and then they keep changing the terms, but the ultimate objective is exactly the same.
Right, it's just progressing. But so we were so in Minnesota it's called the Profile of Learning, and Virginia is called the Standards of Learning, and different places, different things. But we could identify that the federal curriculum was really based, organized into certain themes. They don't use, classes like economics and history and geography and reading and that sort of thing as ends in themselves. Those are just vehicles to communicate the themes. The new education system is themes. And these themes primarily are undermining national sovereignty, redefining what natural rights are, promoting radical environmentalism and multiculturalism, restructuring government, and that sort of thing. So we would deliver examples from the curriculum that the kids were taking home from school and identify through email and meetings and conferences and websites and mailings, that sort of thing. Explain to people how this was the federal curriculum, and so over a period of time with specific examples, and especially relating it directly to our state documents. Every state has their set of standards and their documents that say essentially the same thing. We got this real groundswell of opinion, public opinion, that was that the profile of learning was bad. Now, a lot of people didn't understand exactly what was wrong with it, and people had, various ideas about what made it bad, but essentially it got a bad name in the public, a really bad name. And as that started to build, it became more and more of a public issue. So we began organizing, politically to try to replace a key senator or a key representative here or there based on, their support of this profile of learning, which was the federal curriculum here. And so, by focusing on, a couple of key high-profile races that we could be successful at, it really made a huge impact on the legislators' state of mind. Suddenly, it became a liability in their own mind to be in favor of this system. And so it all came to a head, and it did take a number of years and a couple of different legislative election cycles. That last election cycle, which was the 2002 session, we had legislators all over the state running against the system and winning, and the governor himself ran on this platform and was supported by the state party because of it.
Because of it being in favor or against?
Because he was actually opposing it. It became such a negative in the mind of the public that whatever the problem was with the profile of learning, it was bad. I mean, nobody really wanted to be publicly associated with it. So ultimately, it became a referendum of sorts this last election on this education system, and people ran on it. The governor ran on it, and he won. And so he was determined, and we got a lot of people in both the House and the Senate, to some degree, just because of that issue. And so there was a big push, now to actually throw it out. Well, a lot of people don't know really what it is. I mean, they have a sense, of course, that it's bad. They don't like what they see, but it gets kind of complicated. So we have to be in there all the time. So once you throw it out, of course, the big issue is what do you replace it with? And as you and I both know, I mean, a new form of it comes like a phoenix out of the ashes, and you have the same thing all over again. So last spring we had to put together in the state of Minnesota new standards in language arts and in math, and we worked very hard, to build public opinion and to play a role in that, so that the standards that they developed would actually be different, would be substantially different. And we had a great deal of success. It wasn't everything we wanted, but it was substantially different, very different from what we would have had before. Now we're in the midst of putting together social studies standards and science standards. And here we have an even bigger battle, and that we're just getting into that now. And we just see this as incredibly difficult, but we have a lot of public attention focused on what we're doing, and we have a and what we're doing is, as we walk through this, is focusing the public's attention as much as we can, through whatever way we can, on just how this relates to competing worldviews, so people get a sense of what's at stake here, and so they don't get lost in the details. And we have a quote here from John Fonte that we think pretty well defines what the battle is all about in setting these new standards. And it goes like this. He says, and this is he's a fellow at the Hudson Institute, and he wrote in Policy Review in December of 2000 the words that say, "Beneath the surface of American politics, an intense ideological struggle is being waged between two competing worldviews. The traditional view favors the transmission of the American regime or values, and the other camp favors its transformation." That pretty well puts it in a nutshell. We've got two camps. One wants to use education to transform, and the other, which is the more traditional, which is us, that we want to pass on these principles of freedom to the next generation. And that's this intense ideological battle. And so that's what we're doing right here. And I have to say that the national standards are what have the upper hand by all means. And so we're really swimming upstream. We know that. But what we recognize is that as soon as people understand what's at stake, you know, that this really is a battle of between, you know, America's freedom and its the loss of its freedom, they know which side. I mean, enough people know which side they're on, and we know that if we can have some success in making this a real battle here, it has to be expanded to other states, and it has to be expanded to the federal level too, where the laws are being passed, you know, like No Child Left Behind and other bills as well.
So, well, I think what's so important for our listeners to know is that this whole effort to transform our society is being coordinated by the Bush administration in conjunction with the radical leftists like Ted Kennedy. In fact, Ted Kennedy backed this No Child Left Behind legislation of George Bush's. Why? Because it is intent upon transforming our society and changing the child's view towards God and family and country. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, that is the purpose of the new education system. There's no doubt about it. And I know that at every level of government, there are some people who know exactly what this is, and there are some people who don't know fully what this is. And I think we had talked in an earlier show about, you know, a bill, for example, that's in the Congress right now, that is called the Civics and History Education Act of 2003, and there are some very good congressmen that are supporting that who truly have no idea what this really entails. That's what we've had some success in, actually letting them know what's underneath the surface of these.
Well, they'll talk about things like we're going to teach the Bill of Rights, but of course they teach it entirely differently, don't they? In other words, they put different values than our founding fathers or that even their parents would have. In other words, it's to use the meaning of the Bill of Rights and twist it around to go along with their agenda rather than the traditional American agenda.
Right, exactly. So, what we'll end up with here, no doubt, is they're going to want to say, you know, we'll teach all these, we'll teach the Constitution, we'll teach the Bill of Rights, we'll teach the Federalist Papers, and they won't say anything about how they'll teach it.
Right.
I can quote from the National Standards on Civics and Government, and they say right out that the primary purpose, and this is a quote from them, primary purpose of this textbook is not to fill your head with a lot of facts about American history and government. They say knowledge of these facts is important only insofar as it deepens your understanding of the system and its development. And, of course, they're the ones who are going to provide the meaning that they want you to take from it.
And, of course, they're really trying to indoctrinate people in this belief in world government, aren't they?
Well, they are, and they do it in a way that is very interesting. I'll tell you, there isn't anything that is more missing from the study of civics and government in the standards across the state, across all of the states and the national standards, than the idea of national sovereignty. I mean, truthfully, it doesn't seem to even exist in their mind. If it's ever mentioned at all, it's only slightly in passing. And I mentioned that I'm not anybody that has a lot of background, you know, academic training and whatever. But what I've discovered is that we have to go back, and people like myself have to go back and get to know what the Declaration of Independence actually says for ourselves. I mean, we think we know what it is, but until I really had it pointed out to me, I did not really recognize that the Declaration of Independence begins and ends with a statement of national sovereignty. And, of course, that's one of the reasons that the Declaration of Independence is not as popular as some other documents around. But it begins by saying, it's the first paragraph of the Declaration says, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. And it goes on. So they are talking about requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation.
And of course, they're really talking about nationhood, aren't they? They're talking about nationhood. So
they're talking about what?
About nationhood. In other words, this is a nation that we are going to become a new nation.
That's
we're
right.
Separating from the other nation. So
right.
It has to do with national sovereignty.
National
what they're talking
sovereignty.
About. All right, well, we're going to have to take a break here. And when we get that, we'll be gone for a few minutes. And then, of course, when we get back, why, we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But, of course, if they can control the minds of the children, then they can control the next generation. For it is these people who are there indoctrinating today who will be the legislators and the leaders of tomorrow. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Julie Quist. We're talking about, of course, the effort to change our educational process. And of course, in the past, it was very difficult to do because they would have to go into every individual school district and, of course, influence the individual school district, maybe 10,000 of them across the nation in these ideas. But with the federal control over education that was sold to the American people, by a lie, and that lie was, well, this new program is going to return control to the local school board and to the local school and to the parents where it belongs. And that's what the president told me when we interviewed him when he was still the governor back in 1999. But, of course, maybe he didn't understand what he was about to do because, of course, once he got in office, why he did exactly the opposite, I guess, and, of course, what they did was instead of working to extend local control, they brought in total federal control over education. And for the first time in our history, now we had, in essence, a federal curriculum not laid out by the testing. And, of course, we're federal testing, and that testing, of course, is going to be you have to teach the children what we want you to teach or they're going to fail the test. And the testing, well, I'll let Julie Quist talk about that, but the testing really isn't about reading and writing and arithmetic, is it?
No, actually, there is some of that, but what that is what we call the minimum competencies, and that is you have to know how to do enough math and reading in order to be, you know, able to do a, you know, basic job. But beyond that, they don't do that much of it. The social studies test in Iowa, basics test, for example, which is kind of interesting. It asks a lot of questions, but it never asks any questions of knowledge of presidents that there were, or wars that they were, or what they were fought about, or things like that. They go much more into the attitudes and values that they want to inculcate into the students. And when you said, you know, a federal curriculum, you can see it how it's permeated the entire country, because you can go to any state in the country and you will find these exact same themes. They played out in a little different way, but it's just amazing how completely thoroughly this has been incorporated into every state. And what we find so interesting is that people don't know. I mean, they just don't recognize what's missing. I find it, for example, the standards in Virginia, they're often held up as, now these are especially good standards. They're really specific. They ask the kids to know specific things, and they do that, and that part of it might be okay, but these are the things. We did a review, a quick review of the Virginia standards, and you could find this in any of the standards. But the most fundamental principles of our government are not existent. National sovereignty isn't there. They don't talk about self-evident truth, natural law. They don't talk about equality before God, the principle of unalienable rights. They don't talk about the unalienable rights of life, property, and the purpose of government to secure these rights. They do include popular sovereignty, which is the consent of the governed, but all of these things are included in the Declaration of Independence.
Now, we're going to have to just to take a moment here, because we're going to be then bringing our listeners back up in the Great Northwest back online here. And then, of course, if you're out in the listening audience, you'd like to call us, you know how. Okay, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest Julie Quist from the Maple River Educational Coalition. And Julie, before we get lost here, would you like to get out your website, your telephone number for our listeners?
Sure, we'd love to. It's edwatch.org.
Edwatch.org.
.org. And that's our website. And then our phone number is 651-646-0646. And a really great resource on, you know, the federal curriculum, which you've probably heard on your show before, is FedEd, the new federal curriculum and how it's enforced. And there are other really good articles on the website that continually update. So,
in fact, we carry the book FedEd, written by, of all people, Alan Quist, and we recommend this book very, very strongly. And then we put together a four-tape set, we call it FedEd. And, of course, there'll be interviews there with many of the people you've heard here on the program, trying to make you understand and that there is an agenda, and it is being hidden from the American people. And, of course, you know, if you get the tape sets, you are certainly have our permission to go ahead and duplicate them and to get people thinking. And if you want to get this book, the book on FedEd, economically, of course, where we can make a special arrangements for you to buy it in bulk. This is one of the most important books that's out there. Do you have a video of some sort that you're offering?
Yes, we do. There's a really good video, which is the presentation on FedEd. It includes three different people presenting on there, Senator Bachman and Michael Chapman and Alan Quist. I think you've had all three on your show.
As a matter of fact, I have. But be that as it may, these are all tools that you can use to educate others. People don't understand that the most dramatic changes and drastic and frightening changes in our educational system that have ever existed have come in with a new administration. The first time anybody has had the audacity to mandate a federal educational system. Bill Clinton had one, but of course it was a voluntary one. But this, of course, is mandatory because, of course, they will test, the federal government will test to make sure that the teachers have done a good job in changing the attitudes and values and beliefs of our children. And it's not going to be a strengthening their belief in God and family and country. It will be destroying their belief in God and family and country. So that we're going to talk a little bit more about the concepts there, that how this is being done when we get back in just a moment or two with Julie Quist. And remember, if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, Julie, why don't you sort of explain how they're going to be teaching this doing away with national sovereignty? People don't understand, you do away with national sovereignty, you do away with our constitutional guarantees of freedom. We will have then the same guarantees that they have in North Korea and in Vietnam and in Cuba and in communist China and in the communist government we installed in Rhodesia and the Marxist government we installed in Southwest Africa and Angola and and even to an extent in South Africa, we will have the same freedoms that, of course, exist in Russia today. Of course, they have elections, but it really doesn't matter because the fellow who wins usually comes from the KGB. Putin came from the KGB. Gorbachev came from the KGB. Before him, Andropov came from the KGB. And if you think that, of course, they're going to have free and open elections there, why, of course, you probably believe there's a lot of difference between the Republican and the Democratic Party here in the United States. So why don't you pick up the story there until we go to the break?
Okay, well, let me just mention why national sovereignty is so fundamental and why it just happens to be missing everywhere. Because national sovereignty allows America to be governed as a free and independent nation among nations, and we base our freedom on the rights that are set forth in the Declaration of Independence. Now, if there is no national sovereignty, what they're talking about is one world government, obviously, and that is where the new federal curriculum takes you. They aren't very shy about it. It's pretty clear that they're erasing boundaries. They talk about boundaries as being a negative thing, if we are not a sovereign nation, then we are not going to be able to have our freedom based on the principles that are set out in the Declaration. And that's where I really believe we need to begin to understand much more clearly what those principles are in the Declaration that give us our freedom. Having to do with natural law, self-evident truth, equality before God, the inherent rights of life, liberty, and property, and that government's purpose is to protect those God-given rights. Those are the principles of the Declaration, which national sovereignty protects.
And, of course, what a shame it is that most of our students don't understand national law, natural law, or God's law. They don't understand where any of these ideas came from. And they really don't understand what is basically wrong with the idea of a world government. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a world government? And, of course, there'd be no more wars, that everybody would live happily and prosperously, just like we do here in America. Wouldn't that be wonderful? But unfortunately, that's not what's planned. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Julie Quist. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And well, Julie, as you talk about this, what do you tell people? They say, well, but what's wrong with the world government? Wouldn't it be better if we did have world government and didn't have any laws, any more wars, and where people could all live together peacefully and under the rule of law? And so, from the point of view of, how would you answer that question?
Well, what's made America different in the world, and we have been, this great experiment in freedom, is that we do have certain principles of freedom, and that is what makes us unique. People need to understand, and I should say for myself, I don't think that that I have understood this and appreciated it. I haven't learned it even myself as I grew up the way I would expect that our children should learn them. And I've had to actually relearn them myself, and it's really exciting to discover what it is, what are these things that make us really free. And you can compare, for example, the constitutions of other nations. They use this comparative sort of study in the national standards. They compare the Constitution of the United States, which has unalienable rights that are given by God, to, for example, the Constitution of Cuba or the Constitution of China. And in those countries, it's the government that gives them their rights.
And really, of course, their Constitution gives them all the rights we have, doesn't it? I mean, don't they have freedom of speech and freedom of religion, all those freedoms in those countries?
That's right. And the key difference is that the common good is put above unalienable rights. In our Declaration of Independence, government exists for the primary purpose of protecting our rights, our unalienable rights. And whenever you put the common good ahead of unalienable rights, then government is the one who's giving, who is deciding what you can have and what you can't have, it isn't unalienable. In that case, government can always take it away. And what we've discovered is that whenever there's tyranny, whenever unalienable rights are taken from people, it's always done in the name of common good. They always say, it's for the betterment of the society. That's always the reason. But the government then is the power to take it away because they are the ones to determine what is the common good. So that, you know, this is this idea that the foundation of our liberty is the protection of the rights that are given by our Creator, and then that has made us free, is a revolutionary idea. And in today's society, it's revolutionary too, just like it was before, because we, you know, people don't understand this. And when they start to really understand it, it kind of sets them on fire. they start to realize what it is that makes us unique and what makes us free. And so it isn't just the children that are starting to, I mean, that aren't learning this, it's the adults as well. And, you know, I'm finding people have an interest in this like they've never had before. So.
I sure hope so. In fact, of course, through Radio Liberty, we encourage people to get in. There's something called the Institutes of the Constitution. And, of course, anybody out there who really would like to begin to study this and help other people understand the foundation of our freedom and what makes America different. Let me mention the Institute of the Constitution, and you can get in touch with them by calling 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068 up there in the Spokane area of Washington. And we've got three or four of those groups that have been started up there. And let's hope we get a lot more all across the country. This is a growing movement. And I think what Julie says is absolutely true. It's really exciting to understand why America is different than other countries. But, of course, what's disheartening is to realize that we're losing our difference. And we have a generation of young people who don't know anything about the foundations of our freedom. Well, they can tell you everything bad about America. They can't tell you anything good about America. And many of them, even very intelligent people, are saying, well, of course, the world government's going to come sooner or later, and wouldn't it be better if we could do away with wars, without realizing, of course, the theme that we currently bring out, and that is all the great wars of the last century were fought specifically to create such horror and devastation that people would be willing to give up their freedom and individuality and accept this rule of law, one world government, under the control of a ruling elite. Because it's not going to be a representative government. It is going to be a rule by a ruling elite. And that is why so many people of great wealth and why our great tax-exempt foundations are pushing this idea. Because, of course, they believe in the Platonic model of a ruling oligarchy led by a so-called just man, a massive police force headed by Tom Ridge. I mean, headed certainly to keep the people in line. And, of course, under one guise or another, fighting terrorism or a fear of a communist attack or whatever it would be. You have to have an enemy to get the people to be willing to give up their freedom. But, of course, what people don't understand are the spiritual forces behind this and who the ultimate ruler of this coming world order will be. Well, Julie, now, of course, as you begin talking to people, and they suddenly begin to catch this vision that you and the people up there at the Maple River Educational Coalition have of this idea of the uniqueness of America, that this was the country, this was the city on the hill, this was the beacon of light, this was the hope of all mankind at one time, and how far we've come from that today, as instead of trying to bring others to be free, why, of course, we try to undermine and destroy the very foundations of this structure which gives us our freedom.
Yeah, and, you know, what's really interesting, though, I find is that they're doing it in the name of going back to the founding principles. That's the most insidious part of it. But the important thing to remember is that the reason they're going back to the founding principles and trying to convince people that we're getting our children, we're teaching our children the founding documents, we're teaching them the Declaration, we're teaching them the Constitution, is because they know that that is what people want.
Yeah, but that's
and so they and so we have that going for us because that is indeed what people want right now. They're looking for that and they're being deceived. And I would just like to point out one thing that is a real It just shows how slippery the language is and how you can just, it's hard to take it apart sometimes. It's hard to see through it. And that is the whole idea that you'll find in every set of standards you look at, is that, this is an example, this comes from what Minnesota's original, what was part of what we threw out, but I found it in the Virginia standards, I found it in the California standards, is Minnesota students will understand the rights and responsibilities of the citizen in America government. Okay, the very fact that they always put rights and responsibilities together at the same level is a sleight of hand. Because we think, yeah, well, we all have responsibilities, and yeah, with our rights, we have responsibilities. So you can't really say there's something wrong with that, but something doesn't sound quite right there. And a lot of times you just can't put your finger on it. What's wrong with that statement? Well, you go right back to the Declaration of Independence and you can find out what's wrong with it. Because the Declaration of Independence sets out our the founding principles, and in there we have the self-evident truths, the unalienable rights. You don't get to the responsibilities of government until you start putting those into effect. They are not primary. The primary purpose of government is to protect the rights of people. The responsibilities of citizens is a whole other subject. That's the role of citizenship. So they combine the responsibility of government, the purpose of government, with the responsibility of citizenship together, as if they're mixing apples and oranges. And it's very confusing to people because they're both right, but they're not on the same plane. And by putting them both on the same plane, they have really undermined the priority of the government to protect our rights. And as soon as you can see, you know, as soon as you see that, it starts to all make sense. And you can see, they've really undermined the whole concept of rights by putting responsibilities up in exactly the same level. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And of course, you know, they spend millions of dollars on think tanks to come up with these diabolical programs to confuse people and to make it sound so good. I mean, we want to get back to fundamentals. We want to teach the Constitution, but what are they teaching about the Constitution? We want to teach the Bill of Rights, but what are they teaching? Are they teaching them what people knew 50 years ago, and that is that the Bill of Rights was a restrictive covenant that was to take the chains off of the people and put them on the government and to limit what Congress and the executive branch of government could do? No, that isn't what they teach at all. They change the meaning, and of course, they're going to teach it, but they're going to teach it to destroy it and to destroy these precepts of individual liberty under God. This concept that liberty and limited government are synonymous, that tyranny and total government are synonymous, these concepts are so seminal, so foundational to our society, and yet, of course, there's probably not one in 1,000 school children who graduates today who's ever heard that liberty and limited government go together and tyranny and total government go together. They just don't teach that anymore, and of course, they give you all this gobbledygook to confuse people, and then they tell us, you know, compare the, Bill of Rights to the, Universal Declaration of Rights, and where do you get the most freedom, or where do you get the most rights? Well, then, of course, the Universal Declaration of Rights, you have a right to food and housing and all of these things. These are all rights that the government gives you, but whatever the government gives, the government can take away. In our system of government, you are not entitled to anything. And of course, that is the entire difference. Originally, the power of the central government was to be limited throughout all time, and government was to have nothing to do with education. How they've altered that, and how really diabolically and cleverly they've done it, and the average individual has no glimpse, no idea of what they're doing to the minds of their children.
Yeah, and I can give you just an example of that. When you think about they talk about teaching what it means to have limited government, but they don't talk about the 10th Amendment. And so, you know, the 10th Amendment is what it reserves the powers to the states of all the powers that aren't given to the federal government, and it limits the power of government. So you can't really talk about limited government unless you talk about the 10th Amendment. But the 10th Amendment is ignored for the most part. I mean, they'll make reference to it here or there, but essentially it's ignored. And we have this federal bill that wants to, you know, teach our students. They want to set up federal academies to teach them the foundations of our founding documents. They want to teach the history and the civics of our founding fathers. Well, by setting up federal academies, they're actually violating those very founding principles that they claim they want to teach us, because they are allowed to do that through the limitations that are set on them in the 10th Amendment. So, I mean, they just twist things around so they make, you know, violations sound like they're really a good thing. And people just, you know, haven't figured out that they're really being misled in these words.
And, of course, I think it's so interesting about these academies because, of course, they want to set up 10 of them for the smartest children so they can indoctrinate the potential leaders of the country. And then, of course, they want to, of course, set up 10 of them for teachers where they can indoctrinate the teachers how to indoctrinate the children. How clever that is, of course, you know, and, of course, you go along with the system, why, you're well rewarded. But if you, you know, were to say, well, that isn't what the Constitution says, or that's contrary to the founding fathers' teaching, why, of course, they'll know how to twist and distort the reality of the children to get them to believe that truth is falsehood and falsehood is truth, that America is a democracy, not a republic. In fact, there's probably not one in 1,000 children today who can really explain to you the difference between a republic and a democracy and why our founding fathers decried the idea of democracy and embraced the concept of republic.
Yeah, you know, I'll just mention to you, too, in terms of the course. I mean, this is the federal curriculum, again, and you'll find it in the state standards. They'll, you know, do they teach that the role of the courts is to settle disputes that are based on law, especially on the Constitution? Or is it something different, which of course it is, that they teach the students that the courts are there to reinterpret the Constitution to make it relevant to our times. In fact, the New Civics calls this the informal method of amending the Constitution. The constitutional way of amending our Constitution is the formal way. The informal way is to have the courts just decide it means something else, and they actually teach that as just another method of amending the Constitution.
And, of course, what does it mean, making it relevant to the current time? The Constitution was to be fixed in stone. It could be amended. It could not be changed by men. And we have 9 people wearing black robes who are legislating and, of course, passing laws, and they're violating the oath that they have sworn to uphold, of course, to uphold the Constitution. We've got Jeannie calling, and let's go. Hi, Jeannie. How are you doing?
Well, I'm fine. And, you know, hearing you talk about rights and duties, and I thought that rings a bell. And what that comes out of is a United Nations treaty on the environment and development. They haven't signed that yet, but I was just looking at my book regarding this Universal Declaration, and it actually says that it's going to integrate the environment and development, and it's going to couple rights with duties, especially to duties to the environment.
Are you reading from Agenda 21?
Well, actually, no, this is the draft of a United Nations treaty that hasn't been ratified yet, and it's the Environment and Development Treaty. But it goes right along with saying that the rights are going to be linked with duties that you have to do. And as I remember, that also is said in the Earth Charter.
Yes, it is in the Earth Charter.
Ah, okay.
It's exactly right. And so this is no accident that they are confusing the two. And it's just so important for us to be able to recognize the fallacy in that particular statement, because it doesn't sound, on the surface, it doesn't sound bad, but there's something wrong with it. And as soon as we understand what they've done, we've got to the core of this. They really have made a huge coup by being able to sell this to the public as a founding principle. It's not a founding principle. That's not true. The rights of citizens are guaranteed by government, and their responsibilities are not on the same level as that at all.
Right. And
of course, the rights simply are right to life and to liberty right. and to property, property, because you'll never see the words life and liberty in the Constitution unless, of course, you'll see the word property associated with it. And, of course, that was originally to be in the Declaration of Independence because it was a Lockean phrase. It was put forward by John Locke, who lived in the 1600s, and for whom the idea of nature's God and nature's law came. And, of course, he also wrote about life, liberty, and property. And, of course, somebody changed it from property to pursuit of happiness, and I see nothing wrong with that at all. But we were never guaranteed happiness, only the pursuit of happiness, opportunity, unfettered by restrictions on the part of the government. But, of course, how far we've gone from that today, as we have a government that wants to regulate every aspect of what we do and our property, and of course, fine and imprison us if we dare to in any way infringe on any one of their laws. So, Jeannie, anything else?
Well, I'm glad you're clarifying the difference between rights and duties. Very important. These are smart people.
Oh, they are, and they have a lot of money to learn how to confuse us.
Everything is on the line here with those terms, you know. We have to challenge those terms, because if we let those things slide by, they've really won the day.
I'm sure they have, but of course, people don't even understand that this battle is going on. Between those, of course, who want to transmit to the next generation our values, and those who want to transform our values, and the idea, of course, that there could be people in Washington, D.C., perhaps even surrounding the president, who want to transform our society, who loyally is not to the United States and continuation of American sovereignty, but to this dream, this age-old dream of a new world order and a new world religion. That's what's so hard for people to believe. Why, I couldn't believe that, and yet you only have to look and see as they begin to tear down our trade barriers and transfer our jobs overseas, and, of course, with that, of course, lowering American living standards. And you have to understand this is all a prelude to this idea of this one-world government where everybody lives at the same level. And, of course, the American worker, as his living standards go down, will soon live at the level of the South American or Chinese peasant, but we'll all be happy. And, of course, this is part of a plan. You read the Global Biodiversity Assessment Program that Jeannie, who just was talking to us, actually summarized, and we have it in our Sustainable Development Syllabus. And there it talks about how we could really should only have 2 billion people in the world. And if we're going to have 6 billion, we'll have to lower the living standards of that of the Eastern European or Eastern European present. The idea of we were going to have to lower living standards, that's what this is all about. Now, they're not going to lower the living standards, of the Maurice Strongs or the Stephen Rockefellers or the Mikhail Gorbachev or the Ted Turners. They're going to lower the living standards of the average individual because they have a different worldview. They believe that there should be an elite, and then, of course, the military, and then the common folks. But, of course, in the meantime, how are they going to give up our freedom? Why, of course, they're going to take control of the mind of the next generation. And just as the young people in Russia were brainwashed by years of indoctrination, so the same thing is underway here in America, isn't it, Julie?
Yes. Yeah, and you know, all the things that you're saying there, I think that it's important for people to know that in the education system, they take these standards of civics and government, and they integrate them into all of the standards across the subject areas. For example, literature, language arts, science, math. All of these ideas that you were just articulating there are intentionally, deliberately, and in an organized way integrated into everything. For example, they have books, children's literature and social studies, building bridges, they say, connecting classroom knowledge with social issues, linking literature with life, those sorts of things. And so, for example, in the California standards, they'll say, the framework here, the teacher is expected to integrate the teaching of history with the other humanities and social disciplines. The teacher is also expected to work with teachers from other fields such as language arts, science, and the visual and performing arts in order to achieve correlation across subjects. So you have here the core curriculum. You were talking about population growth and the environmentalism and the standard of living and all of that. And all of those themes, those same themes are incorporated into all of the science, all of the math, all of the language arts, the literature, what kinds of literature you choose. So we have to recognize the themes that they're trying to communicate and then follow them through all the subject areas and not just look at one subject area or another, because the civics standards are the ones that go across all other subject areas. I think that people really need to recognize that when we're going right to the core of our founding documents here, our principles of freedom, we can follow those same principles throughout every single subject area, and we can address them in very much the same way that they have undermined them.
Well, you know, I think it's so interesting that, of course, the last thing our federal founders, our founding fathers wanted was a federal control of education. In fact, it was Karl Marx who wanted federal control of education, and in his Communist Manifesto, he called for a free public education for every child. Why? Because, well, Lenin said it quite well. Give me the minds of the children of one generation, and I can control that nation. And that's really what it's all about. And you say, well, of course, those were communists, but our leaders are... No, there's no communism in Russia. Communism is an elitist concept, which is why, of course, if you go to the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations, you'll find under glass there one of the most treasured possessions of the members of the CFR. It was a copy of their magazine, Foreign Affairs, that Lenin had read. They eulogized Lenin. They worshiped Lenin. After all, he was a dictator, and this is the ultimate plan and ultimate goal. As you go through the speakers they've had there at the CFR through the years, why, of course, all of the major communist leaders, whether Fidel Castro or Khrushchev or Andropov, they've all been there, lecturing at the Council on Foreign Relations. Why? Because the goals are exactly the same. One world government, the new world order. And, of course, most people would be surprised to know that Fidel Castro is a favorite of the people of the CFR. Why, he's supposed to be the enemy of capitalism. Well, of course, there's a great deal of a difference between what we think and what the truth is. As somebody said, symbolism over substance, why tinsel over truth? But, of course, tinsel glitters, but it conceals the truth. And this is really what it's all about. We have to understand there are people who really do have a different worldview. They really do want to do away with national sovereignty and individual freedom and certainly a belief in the God of the Bible. In fact, one of the most interesting things, Julie, that I've heard about this new curriculum is it begins to introduce these pagan beliefs into the minds of our children. But have you gotten into that at all?
Oh, we really have. Many people think Well, this idea of the separation of church and state, I have to say that the people who are promoting this new world order and this new world view don't believe in that separation of church and state, because their church is really the schools and the government. You can't stay neutral on these subjects for very long, and pretty soon, and I think Marie Strong is a good example of that, you start getting into... There's got to be some meaning in the universe, and pretty soon the universe itself becomes the meaning, and it becomes the Gaia principle. The Gaia principle, which is that nature itself is God. It's like a pantheism, but I mean, there's nature is something that we are subject to, and not nature, not the other way around. And that comes through in all of the environmental science studies, and you'll find it going through the literature readings too. You'll find that whole approach to nature completely permeating the curriculum in literature and language arts. So, You just can't get away from it, and there is no neutrality in terms of they don't deal with religion. And the only religion that they really are opposed to, apparently, is the Christian religion, and otherwise everything else is kind of open game, particularly a pantheistic kind of religion that becomes very extreme in some cases.
And they really teach the children about how we're all one with nature. all one with the trees and the forest. And this, of course, is this religion of the Indians before the coming of the white man. Very pantheistic. And yet, of course, in some places they're actually teaching this. If you read the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report put out by the Second Earth Summit in 1992 under the auspices, of course, of Stephen Rockefeller, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Marie Strong. And we have a summary of that in the Sustainable Development Syllabus. And they talk about how, you know, how if we have to get back to this belief, of course, that we are all one with the trees and the rocks. And you wonder, what sort of madness is this? Well, of course, they have a different worldview. And, of course, they have come up with the new Ten Commandments. It's called the Earth Charter. And they put it in a replica of the Ark of the Covenant. They call it the Ark of Hope. And, of course, they have a plan for humanity. And, of course, if you read their writings, they will tell you the greatest threat to the world today is Christianity, Judaism, and the Muslim religion. And that's why, at least one reason why we're engaged in a battle with the Muslims today is the Christian kills the Muslims and the Muslim kills the Christian. And then, of course, they'll eliminate both groups. And then they could move towards the new pantheistic religion they believe in. We're going to be back here in just a moment here to wrap up this program. And we'll, of course, have to say goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest. And we ask you, of course, if you believe that there's a problem, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. The book FedEd or the four-tape set FedEd, or give a call to 651-646-0646 and get in touch with the Maple River Educational Coalition. You have an obligation to be involved. Good night. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us this evening Julie Quist from the Maple River Educational Program up there in Minnesota. And these people have done a wonderful job. A small group dedicated to make a difference can make a difference, and you out there in the listening audience can make a difference too. If you care about your freedom, if you care about your family, if you care about your future and future generations. So if you care about freedom, why, you're going to get involved in this battle. At least I hope you will. And, of course, that's why we're here, is to offer you our things that we have available and certainly the wonderful facilities and information they have at the Maple River Educational Coalition. And basically, there is a clash of civilizations. It's not a clash between Christian civilization and the Muslim religion. The real clash is between the Judeo-Christian civilization, and these people who had transformed the world to their own liking. And they're really here. They're working at the highest echelons of our government, and now they're transforming our educational system. Their goal is to control the minds of the next generation. And, you know, of course, as Julie pointed out, most people, most Americans love our way of life. Most people are horrified to realize what's going on. And when they suddenly realize what's going on, and then, of course, they suddenly realize that, that some of their own legislators are backing this, why, of course, then they get very incensed. And you've been able to actually vote some of these people out of office?
Yeah, actually we have, and you have to be a little strategic about it sometimes, and you have to show a few successes that you can really point to. So if you can, if you have a group of people statewide who can communicate with each other, email is real effective, websites are real effective, rallies and conferences, all those things, that happen to, keep people together. If you can kind of rally people around, focusing on some real strategic races, just one or two of them to start off with, and actually overturn somebody on this issue, it makes a huge impact statewide, and then all the other people are thinking, how is this going to affect my race? And, I will tell you, truthfully, the public, if they have the information, is for the most part on our side. And you and I, know that the biggest challenge is to get people, the good information, because they're too busy, they don't care that much or whatever. I'll tell you the good news, though. The good news is that people really want to get back to the basics of what this country is about. And nobody knows that better than the people who are trying to manipulate our future and transform our country. And they know that, and so they're using the language of patriotism that people really do believe in. They're using the language of teaching basic principles, and they're doing something entirely different with it. But they know that's what people right now are hungry for, and that's the thing that we can take advantage of. We can tell people where this isn't what it is not what they are being told it is. And when you really look at some of the specifics in each state or at the national level, it's not that hard to find it. You just have to look for it. And I would like to maybe talk a little bit about what people can actually do, to actually communicate some of these.
You go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I think it's very important for people in their own states to go to their standards, to their state standards, and to just look at some of the language and to look to see, what is it that's there and what is it that's missing? And at first it seems like there's a lot there, but it's really not that hard to navigate. So one of the things that we're going to do here is we're going to take one set of standards, and we're going to take the Virginia standards because they're the ones that have been elevated as supposed to be, really the good civics and government standards. We're going to put those on our website, by tomorrow. And then we've got a little critique of them. And if you can go to our website and kind of follow that along, you can do the same thing in your own state and look to see if the same things are missing. So for example, we've just looked at what they had there, and we say, they say that they're going to study the basic principles of our Constitution and our founders, but what's missing? And then we itemize what's missing. Well, national sovereignty is missing. basic unalienable rights are missing. The right to life, liberty, and property is missing. And I would like for people to start to actually look at their own standards and say, I want to see what is it that's basic to our own country, to the principles of freedom in the Declaration of Independence, that's not included in my standards. And once you find that, that's what you want to communicate to the public. That's the thing, because that is exactly what the other side is trying to convince us that they are doing. They're trying to tell people that they're teaching the principles of our country, and in fact, they're not.
All right, and they are not, and that's the thing that people have to first of all understand what America was all about. An awful lot of confusion on the part of people. An awful lot of people don't understand the difference between a democracy and a Republican, and they honestly believe we're a democracy. And once you begin to let them understand that they've been lied to consistently, and of course all the history points in that direction, the writings of our founders and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Federalist Papers, you'll never once see the word democracy other than to decry it and say the last thing we ever want would be a democracy in the United States. And so, you know, quoting Plato, quoting Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and John Adams and John Quincy Adams and even Oscar Wilde and Charles Beard, they all understood that we were never to become a democracy. So how could all those people know that? And it could be, of course, written into our founding papers, as it was in the Federalist Papers, and yet not known today simply as a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think.
And we really do need a reinvigorating search for what is true, and I do think that that's beginning. One of the things we can we've kind of tried to point out to people also on our website is the difference, a comparison between the traditional view of certain ideas and then what is the new radical view. So, you know, I could just kind of go through some of those and just point out the differences in the new civics versus what we traditionally think they mean.
I like that idea of calling them the radical or the extremist, because, of course, the use of adjectives is so efficient, or, the word radical, because these are radical ideas. America, of course, is tradition. These are radical. These are extremist. These are communitarian or communistic or call it what you will, but it's an effort to destroy the very foundations of the what's made America the envy of this world. And I think when people understand that these people are lying, and of course really what they're teaching the children, at that point I'm hoping, of course, that this could be a turning point, when the majority of the people understand that they've been lied to. At that point, I would hope that there would be a tremendous moral outrage and moral indignation, and people would say, hey, maybe I'm going to have to get involved.
And you know what's interesting is that we're not name-calling when we use the word radical, because they actually use that word themselves in their own materials. They say this is a radical transformation. So, I mean, we're just saying what they already admit. They know that's what it is. So we'll take them at their word. But let me just say, we talked already about the purpose of government, and you know the traditional view, of course, on that, as we discussed, is protect the inherent God-given rights. But the radical view of that is to enhance the common good, or a combination of both of them, which is a complete undermining. And that's one of the key distinctions between the traditional view and the radical new civics is they want to say that the purpose of government is to enhance the common good rather than to protect the inherent rights. But another, the real key distinction between the traditional view and the radical view is what is the role of the courts. So in the traditional view, the courts is to settle disputes based on laws, on the Constitution. The radical view is that you're amending the Constitution using the informal method of the courts and to interpret the Constitution so that it's relevant to the times. Okay, that's another key theme. A third way comparison of the old, the traditional principles of freedom is having to do with how federalism is defined. So for traditional view, powers are separated between the federal government and the states, and the Constitution delegates, those are the delegated powers, certain powers to the federal government, and then those not delegated to the federal government are reserved powers for the states and the people. And that's right there in the 10th Amendment. Well, the radical view will take the 10th Amendment just ignored, and it's out of sight, out of mind. So we just don't even deal with that in the new civics. Another real key distinction in the new civics and the radical view is who were the founders of our nation. So in the traditional view, the founders of our nation are those people who actually played a really important role in creating the United States. Now, in the radical view, the founders of our nation are those people who are underrepresented in our history books and who have supposedly been exploited by white males. So you'll find that they'll find all sorts of reasons to bring in people who played very superficial roles, but if they're part of an underrepresented group, they get elevated to very high place in the history of the country, when in fact they had sometimes very little to do with what happened. Let's see, another would be how was our nation formed? The traditional view would be that our nation was formed by immigrants who were primarily from Europe, and they brought their religious and cultural beliefs and traditions with them. The radical view, on the other hand, is that our nation was formed by a combination of three cultures, European, African, and Native American. So it's a multicultural view of our history. Completely revisionist view of history does not recognize the centrality of the European Judeo-Christian culture that created America as we know it today. And then another would be, how should government be studied? Okay, so the traditional view is that civics and government are academic disciplines that should be studied by courses within these disciplines. That's the way you do it. But the radical view is that civics and government are various themes that should be studied in every course that includes mathematics and science, and we already talked about that. You know, how it's integrated. It's an integrated study of themes rather than a subject matter. Another, should the culture and government of the United States be promoted? Here's where the rubber really hits the road, because the traditional view is, well, yes, of course. The United States has been, you know, it's been a light on the hill, a beacon of freedom, opportunity, and prosperity for the rest of the world. In the radical view, at very best, all cultures are equal, but at worst, the United States government and the culture has exploited the rest of the world. And, you know, teachers are actually being trained that they're not supposed to have a bias in favor or against, you know, the United States. Well, they do have a bias, and it's usually against, but, I mean, it's considered bad form to be promoting the principles of our government because they would be showing a bias, which is just hard to, so the public doesn't understand that. I mean, they just can't imagine that that's true. But, you know, we really need to point that out to them. Let's see, what's another one? What does it mean to study democracy? Okay, in the traditional view, it means to study the principles of government, and there are some comparisons that can be made to other democracies, but primarily, the United States government is the standard. In the radical view, what it means is that you study all democracies of the world, and you find out what they have in common. And these common traits are viewed as being, you know, superior to our government if they're common to everybody. And so, again, we don't have that standard of our country. You just look at what's common between all countries of the world. And then here, the relationship between rights and government, you know, the government exists to protect rights. We've talked about that. The radical view is that there's a balance between people's rights and their responsibilities. Then the other one is, what is a Republican form of government? And this one, I think people they really misuse the language here when they talk about Republican form of government. In the traditional view, a Republican form of government is representative government as described in our Constitution. You've mentioned that a number of times here tonight. So the radical view is that a Republican form of government believes that the common good takes priority over individual rights. Now, you have to know that they're using it that way in the textbooks, in the national standards, and in the state standards. They actually define republicanism in that manner. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. But, of course, it has nothing to do with it. I mean, the republicanism certainly was a representative government, but the power of the elected representatives was limited by the change of the Constitution. So that, and, of course, as Jefferson had said, you know, we say that men can't govern themselves, so why should we think that men should be able to govern another? One group of men should be able to govern another. Have we found angels to be our governors? And, of course, it was so ridiculous that we could trust people with power. And so even though we elected our representatives, what they could do was limited, and you had your checks, and you had your balances, and you had your Tenth Amendment. And then, of course, you had your checks and balances between the federal and the state government, and between the state government and the local government. And everything was done, of course, to fragment it, government, so it could never become tyrannical. And boy, have we got a long way from there.
And isn't it interesting? They have literally turned that entirely upside down. Let me just, in lesson three from We the People, the Citizen and the Constitution, they talk about what did the founders learn about republican government from the ancient world. And they go back to Greece and Rome in this chapter, and they talk about classical republicanism is the theory that the best kind of society is one that promotes the common good instead of the interests of only
The individual. Now, where did they possibly get that? Because there's nothing in the, of course, the writings of the ancients that would suggest that that was what they meant by a republic at all.
In fact,
in Rome, they had elected senators, but the senators had to abide by the law. They could not expand the power of government more than, of course, the law allowed them to. And so, in the Roman Republic, the power of the government was limited, as was ours. The beauty of our society was, as Jefferson said so well, in matters of politics, speak not to be of confidence in men, but rather bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution. And then, of course, everybody understood what John Locke had said, and that is that the government governs best, or that government governs best, that governs the least. And, of course, Jefferson said there are certain things that government should do, and that is, of course, to provide law and order and security, and over and above that, nothing else, absolutely nothing. Let people make their own way. Let them make their own mistakes.
Yeah, well, I want to describe it a little bit more, because people have to become familiar with this. This is the federal standards, the national standards, because they completely mix all that up. In a classical republic, I'm reading from the standards, citizens and their government are supposed to work cooperatively to achieve the common good rather than their own interests. The Roman Republic was thought to be one of the best examples. Americans in the 18th century shared the view that citizens should work to promote the common good. They also believed that the type of government and society most likely to promote the common good was only possible if the society and its citizens shared the following characteristics, and these are civic education, moral education, and small uniform communities. So then they describe what civic virtue is, and they describe civic virtue, which, of course, we all... That sounds good. Civic virtue sounds good. We all have our own response. I mean, I feel like I'm taking part in civic virtue by, doing things to defend and protect, our principles of freedom, but that's not what they mean. The classical republics demanded that their citizens have a high degree of civic virtue. I'm quoting again from the national standards. A person with civic virtue was one who set aside personal interests to promote the common good. So again, they're not, of course we're promoting the common good. We're looking for freedom for our children and for our country, but you don't promote the common good by elevating the common good above the rights, unalienable rights, again, of individuals. So they say in the new standards, in the new civics, they say that the Lockean idea of government was selfishness and everybody just do their own thing and not care about anybody else. But the classical Republican form of government is the common good. You have to become familiar with this new language. It's really awful.
Well, of course, what they're really talking about is communism. This is actually what it is, the whole idea of we're all in the common good. We all, of course, give up our individual freedoms for the common good. Mm-hmm. And, of course, what is that? From each according to his ability, to each according to their need.
Mm-hmm.
We provide for everybody, and, of course, the system just doesn't work. And all you need to do is see what's happening over in Europe today. Of course, all of these socialist countries, France and Germany, are suddenly having to go back on the promises they've made to the people, and they're going to have to work to be older before they can get the retirement, and they're going to have to cut back on their pensions, and because none of these things, these collectivist ideas, are always a failure, simply because of the inherent selfishness of man. But you can have compassionate people, and of course that's where the part that Christianity plays, creating a compassionate individual who would do unto others as they would have them do unto you, as it says in the Bible. But of course, they have did everything that they could to destroy morality and to destroy Christianity. And then from whence does this sense of morality come from? It certainly doesn't work because it's totally against the very essence of humankind. And you can't repeal human nature no matter how hard you try. It didn't work in Russia. It didn't work in China. And it's certainly not going to work here. But what it is going to do is destroy the last great hope for the world.
Yeah, and I tell you, it is so brazen. It just amazes me that they can be so outspoken in this. They've taken the natural rights philosophy, which stresses the rights of the individual, and they have put it as the opposite of what they call classical republicanism, which is stressing the common good. And of course, there's some truth to stressing the common good above the rights, but to call it classical republicanism is bizarre. And let me just quote you one other place because you'll appreciate this. Classical Republicans believed that if people differed greatly, they would divide into factions or interest groups rather than work together for the common good. To prevent this, citizens should be encouraged by education and example to avoid the development of great differences in their ownership of property, religion, and way of life.
So we should not have differences in our ownership of property?
That's what they say here. Isn't that amazing? This is in the National Standards, We the People curriculum that is written with taxpayer dollars and is being promoted as the National Standards.
Gee, I wonder if the Bush family is going to give up their hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, in the name of the common good.
I think that we have no idea what they're really teaching here until we actually look at it. They have come down this road so fast. And we found it very helpful to take some of these quotes and to deliver them to our congressmen and to show them what it is that our taxpayer dollars are funding. And it just their eyes get big and they say, I had no idea. Now, the Center for Civic Education put these standards together, and it was in 1994 that they were given the money and the authority to put these standards together and to put this textbook together called We the People, and they've been doing it ever since. But they are out there in Washington, D.C., lobbying for things that sound really good. I mean, they lobby for things called traditional American history, and they lobby for things like presidential academies to teach traditional history. And so when we talk to people and we say, the Center for Civic Education has put together these abominable standards, they at first, you know, they think, well, you know, this is a pretty good group. I mean, it's been around for a long time. They're pretty reputable. They've written a book, sounds real good, We the People. And then we just give them, you know, some of the quotes that I just read to you. And their jaws just drop.
Now, where can we get these things? In fact, you've had the whole list of the difference between their view and our view.
Right.
And, of course, these quotations from the national standards, are they up on your webpage?
Well, I'll tell you, the ones that I just was reading, we're going to get those up by tomorrow because we just put that comparison together. And the reason that we're being compelled to put these comparisons together and these quotes together is because we have to come up with these new standards in Minnesota. And what we're saying is, look, we repealed the profile of learning, so we don't want the same thing as we had before. Here's the difference between the old, and here's what we really want. I mean, here's what we had with the profile, and here's the real traditional. And we're trying to get some real specifics, so we will have that on our website tomorrow.
All right, fine.
EdWatch.org.
I'm sorry, what is that now?
EdWatch.org.
EdWatch.org. And I think it's so important that people understand and they get this information. And would you mind if I put a copy of those and put those up on my website as well?
Sure, that'd be great.
And in fact, I think we probably have a link to yours. But, you know, I just want people to be able to read these things and see the information that, of course, is there. And you're not getting it from Barbara Walters or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw because they're paid not to reveal but to conceal what's really going on. And, you know, when the American people could really understand what's happening I mean, the one weapon we have is truth. The other side controls the media, they control the educational system, they control the government, they control the wealth, and all we've got is God and truth on our side. But I wouldn't trade with them for anything, because one day they're going to have to stand before the maker of heaven and earth and explain why they've done what they've done and their betrayal. But for the time being, we still, of course, have an obligation to be involved. And everybody out there in the listening audience has an obligation to be involved. And if you can't do anything else, get a copy of this tape and listen to it over and over and over again until you can express this as well as Julia does, because you really have a very, very excellent grasp of this.
Well, thank you. But and we'll get this up as quickly as we can on our website, and then you can take it and just put it on yours if you'd like. There's nothing that's copyrighted in this. So.
Well, I think it's so vitally important that people really do understand that there are people with a different worldview. And you say, oh, you think there's a conspiracy. Well, these people have a different worldview, and they admit that these are radical ideas. And, of course, the fact you haven't heard of them, why haven't you heard of them? I believe because there's a conscious effort to conceal what's being done. And, of course, what's a conspiracy but something done in secret? And you can call it a conspiracy. You can call it a coordinated, organized, orchestrated effort. Call it what you will. Doesn't really matter. But there is a plan to transform our society, indeed, to transform the world from what it was to what, of course, these people want it to be. And, of course, will it be a better world? I don't think so, because these people have a different worldview, and they really, if they have
their way,
of course, they would destroy Christianity as we know it. And I'm going to ask, of course, our producer to get Julie back on the line somehow or other. We lost her. But, you know, these things are so vitally important for you, the listener, to have the information at your fingertips and to help us get the information. So, Andy, if you wouldn't mind, of course, getting Julie back on the line, then, of course, we'll open up our lines here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And you must understand that they have targeted the mind of the youth. And, of course, the whole secret to being able to accomplish what they have was to get us this idea of all federal government controlling education. It's fascinating how they did this. They started out by holding up our development of the first satellites. And, of course, we were ready to put satellites up, you know, in the late 1940s, certainly during the early 1950s, under the Eisenhower administration. But the Eisenhower administration wouldn't let them put up the satellites. We had ready to go at the Redstone Arsenal. And, of course, the communists are stealing and perhaps even being given our secrets. We're able to put up the first Sputnik. And then they said, oh, look, the communists are ahead of us. Well, we need, of course, government aid to universities so that they can have better libraries and better education. And we can't let the communists get ahead of us. What we need, of course, is a little help to the universities, and that a lot of help to the universities. And then, of course, we'll begin providing scholarships to the universities. And then, and now, of course, we have federal control of every aspect of education. They do it a little at a time, like the thief at night. Of course, when people don't really understand what's happening, then one day we wake up, and of course we have total control over federal education and over the minds of our children. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Julie Quist. And Julie, we got you back on the line?
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Oh, well, those things happen. Those gremlins get into the telephone lines at times under any circumstances. Why? If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question, don't be hesitant to call us at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But this is really the most fascinating expose of these people who work behind the scenes. And, of course, a lot of these people are funded by the great tax-exempt foundations, aren't they?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, this it's the foundations that really drive this agenda. And, of course, the schools will always go wherever the money is. And this is one of the biggest destructive things that can happen, because decisions are being made in the schools based on what private foundations want, because they will provide the money for it. So there's not just restructuring. Well, let me give you an example of the new math. This is the math curriculum. I'm sure this can be replicated in other kinds of curriculum, but I have seen it very, very clearly in all states in the country in the new math.
Now, could you define the new math, though?
It's integrated math, and integrated math does a couple of things. One is that it integrates the social studies curriculum into the math. So you've got, I mean, the primary purpose of the math is not to learn algebra and geometry or whatever. You learn some of that, you have to learn some basic knowledge, but it's the worldview that you're communicating. One of the worldviews that they communicate is the idea that there are no right and wrong answers, even in math. That that answers actually are come to by consensus of the group. Now, I mean, I know that sounds far out, but I mean, and I don't have that quote in front of me, but I have that quote, and I can tell you exactly where that says it. So it's an undermining of it's a constructivist math where you can construct your own math. You know, there are different ways to do it, different meanings to it, and whether you come up with the right answer or not is really not all that important.
Now, that's the most ridiculous thing. You know, I'm not insulting you, but I'm insulting the people. I mean, after all, if you're giving change for a dollar and you only give something that is close to the change, people are going to be unhappy. And
right.
Of course, if a fellow who's employing you makes out your paycheck and says, "Well, it really doesn't matter how much I give. Let's just give this amount, and rather than what you're entitled to," most people would be, well, they'd be furious.
Right. And, you know, you would think that if there's any place where you really would stick to the facts, it would be in math, because, you know, you've got to come up, like you said, with an answer. But this just demonstrates that the actual subject material is not what's important in the new curriculum. It's the themes of that they're trying to communicate. In this case, it would be the theme that, you know, of that you create your own meaning. That's a theme throughout everything. But
what do you mean you create your own meaning?
Well, that's what constructivism is. You construct. It's also the multiculturalism perspective of their worldview. That, you know, there is no right and wrong. There is no reality. You don't discover truth because there is no truth. It's only what culture you belong to that it looks like it's this from this perspective. It looks like it's something else from another perspective, and there isn't any objective truth. That's what constructivism is. You create. It is for you what you want it to be, and that's the diversity worldview. And they use that same worldview in math to teach that perspective. The one thing that they do that is absolutely true for them is that there is no absolute truth, and there is no right and wrong. I mean, they will tell you, don't teach your kids there is a right and wrong answer. I don't mean just values of right and wrong morally. I mean, there is no right and wrong answer. All knowledge is relative. It's all arbitrary. It's all man-made. And that, of course, undermines the whole scientific knowledge of the world, where we believe there's an objective world out there. We go through scientific method to discover it, and it's there for us. And that's a whole different worldview. That's the traditional worldview. And there's where we come up with the words critical thinking. Critical thinking for us, for me, what I would have thought it meant and what I've always thought it meant before was that you learn to discern what the truth is. You're critical enough to try to ask the right questions so that you come up with the right answer. That's not what it means in the world today. Critical thinking, since there is no truth, there is no reality that's objectively true, critical thinking means that it's a way to get to the worldview that they want you to get to. You come to a consensus of what the truth is. It is whatever the group decides it is. That's the critical thinking, where you're critical of the things that you have been trained in traditionally. What they mean when they say that the children should be taught critical thinking is that they need to learn to be critical of the traditional thinking, and it's just a complete twisting of the terminology. But we've come a long ways from talking about the foundations.
All right, fine. Well, of course, let's go to Kurt, who's calling in now. But I think that the when you talk about this idea, there is no right and there's no wrong. This, of course, is the very essence of a belief in a God. If there is a God, then there is a right and wrong. If there is no right and there is no wrong, then there is no God. And of course, that is really what the whole purpose of education is today, to destroy a belief in a supernatural being that rules in the affairs of men, that created mankind and the heavens and the earth. Because, of course, if you can destroy a belief in God, it's not that people believe in nothing. They'll believe in anything, and they'll begin to embrace your pagan beliefs that we are one with the nature and with the trees and the rocks and with God. In fact, we are God. And as incredible as it may seem, I wonder how many people remember that scene out on a limb with Shirley MacLaine, where she's standing on the beach screaming, "I am God. I am God." And that is the insanity we're up against today. Of course, once you're God, you can do whatever you want to. And that, of course, is why we're in so much trouble today, not with our children, but with our leaders, who, of course, are answerable to no higher power other than themselves. Well, let's go to Kurt. Hi, Kurt. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, well, a quick comment off something just said since I called. What your guest is saying about critical thinking, if you want to see that in action, just go talk to the students from the local university here.
Talk a little louder.
I'm sorry. If you want to see that quote-unquote critical thinking in action, you know, that consensus of opinion, talk to the students at the local university.
Well, because they're being brainwashed there. It'll take 20 years to undo all the damage that they've done.
Oh, indeed. Now, in 1985, I was offered a job, and I called Constance Cumby and explained the situation and said, should I take it? And she said, well, you'd be the only one on campus telling the students what the truth is. And I'm going, oh, no, don't say that. But I was offered the job as chairman of a department of a college here in the Monterey Bay area, a New Age college. And when I would go to lunch with the owner of the college, he would tell me that I had to learn this new vocabulary, this new way of talking. Well, there were certain buzzwords that I had to use all the time. They had this special jargon. And then he would demonstrate with someone else in the room where he would be talking to me, but he'd really be talking to the third party, and every third or fourth word would be a code, and they would be having a conversation totally unrelated to the conversation that appeared to be going on in the room.
Right.
And he stressed how in their style of teaching or being or whatever, they would have to live that way, and I would have to learn that jargon and be able to talk to people in code so I could have one conversation with one person but really be talking to another person in the room. They actually teach that kind of thing.
Well, I'm not surprised at all. I think that's fascinating, Kurt. Anything else you wanted to say?
I wanted to point that out. There is one other thing. Is you mentioned colleges with federal funding. Are you familiar with Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan?
Yes, I am.
Uh-huh. Okay. That's a very good one because they don't allow any students with any federal funding of any kind.
Right. Okay, well, thanks so much for calling.
Sure.
And let's go to Mike here. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Stan?
Yeah, are you there?
We're on, yeah. I wanted to get into the nature of truth and there is no truth and the critical thinking because this embodies the religion that's behind the New World Order and our new educational system.
Right, you're absolutely right. And, of course, there's a do away with absolutes, then anything goes.
Yeah. We've heard of biological Darwinism, you know, the evolution of the species and natural selection. And we've also heard of social Darwinism, which assumes that society is evolving into some place where it wants to go. There's also, I think some people have conceptualized intellectual Darwinism, which has to do with knowledge and the increase of knowledge, and knowledge is power, and all these things. And so geniuses are regarded as some sort of a spiritual elite, and all these sorts of things. And campus radicals are supposedly so intellectual that they're so far beyond us that they can say, what's what in the world? But there's also a spiritual Darwinism, Darwinianism, that goes along with all this. And they bring us these ideas of the nature of truth such that truth is evolving. And so I believe critical thinking then is thinking that is exploring truth. Truth is something that will evolve as the species evolves socially and intellectually, and of course spiritually. And so truth is something that it has to be continually embraced as it evolves, as we grow as individuals and as a community, or as a group of societies, or as a one world society in its final form of along the path of evolution. Excuse me while I grapple with this myself. I don't know if I'm making sense to many of the listeners, but just as there is a individual state of samadhi, reaching nirvana for the guru and the adepts in the Eastern mysticisms, eventually there would be a global state of nirvana that I think that the philosophers behind the educational system want to push us as a global society towards reaching.
I think that the best laid out by Barbara Mark Supper to talk about people evolving to a higher state of consciousness. And, of course, those who can evolve to a higher state of consciousness will be among the elite of the future. And there are some people like you and I, of course, who won't be able to evolve. And as Barbara Mark Supper said, of course, they will have to be eliminated. That's not your job, my dear. That is ours for, and referring to Revelation 6:8. For we are the riders of the pale horse death. Okay, yes. Anything else, Mike?
Well, just like you're saying, those of us who believe in Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord, Master, Creator of the universe, will be so rigid in our thinking we won't be able to evolve their way, which is to the depths of hell.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much, Mike. And Julie, what are your thoughts about
that? Oh, I would love to comment on that. He is so he was so good there. I wanted to just mention that in the new science standards, the organizing principle of everything is evolution. So that it's not just that they teach evolution as a fact. That's not enough. But it is incorporated into every single element of what they teach in the whole range of science. But it is also incorporated into across the other disciplines as well. So you do have the whole evolutionary approach. What they're teaching here in civics is evolution. It's the evolution of our constitution, of our government, and we're evolving toward one world government. And you know, it is the organizing principle around which the students learn so much of what they are taught, and it just is transferred over into the social studies realm. I think a really good example of that is the National Standards Textbook, We the People. They ask, what did the founders mean by returning to the first principles? And so they don't say, what were the first principles? They ask, what did the founders mean by returning to the first principles? And when they do that, they say, it is doubtful that the founders had in mind, and this is a quote, an uncritical acceptance of the wisdom of the past. In revisiting these principles, each generation must examine and evaluate them anew. Indeed, it is probable that the founders would be surprised at the reverence in which they and their writings have been held by subsequent generations. The founders themselves, this is a quote, were vigorous critics of the wisdom they inherited and the principles in which they believed. They were articulate, opinionated individuals who loved to examine ideas, to analyze, argue, and debate them. They expect no less of the future generation. In other words, it is evolving. They never really believed in unalienable rights. It was just an idea of their day. They would have expected you to challenge it and say that it really was good for them, but it's not good for us anymore.
Boy, if there was ever anything subversive, it's exactly what these people are advocating. Let's go to Ed, who's calling us from Idaho. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. How are you?
Doing great.
What you're discussing right now is nothing new.
Could you speak a little louder?
I'm sorry. What you're discussing now is nothing new. It's born out of Gnosticism.
Right.
And Albert Pike wrote about it in Morals and Dogma. What is true today will not be true tomorrow.
Right.
This is the same old, same old.
Yeah, it's like a deja vu all over again, isn't it?
Yes, but they're teaching it openly to the children. I've been observing this when my kids were young in school, and these absurd teaching methods, which are, it's not an education at all. As you say, it's brainwashing.
It's indoctrination.
Indoctrination.
Right. So, of course, what are you doing? Have you got your kids out of public school yet?
Oh, my kids are grown now.
Okay.
But, and I, unfortunately, I had to teach, have them read the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers so that they would have understanding of truth. But what's going on in the school system is just absurd.
Well, help us to get the word out, Ed, and I'll tell you what the book by Julie's husband is the best thing we've got. Phyllis Schlafly said it's one of the most important books of modern times, and she's absolutely right. And we have not only that, but a four-tape setter. Get the information off their website at Ed Watts, and help us to get the information out. Get people listening to Radio Liberty. That's the most important thing. And then
all the time,
get them educated. Why, then, of course, they can become active, and you ought to be able to take over Idaho. The foundation you got up there, why Idaho could be the first the state to return, well, maybe the second state, along with Minnesota, to return to the principles of our founding fathers.
We need to take the country back.
Go ahead, Michelle. Go ahead, Julie.
Okay. I just wanted to mention to you that, they say, people say, well, now they're just being more overt about teaching this and they've been teaching it and everything. A lot of conservatives say, it's the NEA, they're teaching this really bad material. Let me just point out that what I was reading to you was not from the NEA. It was from the national standards, which is required by federal law. And so it is the same people who wrote this textbook are writing the framework for the NAEP. That's the National Assessment for Educational Progress. They have the contract. Well, guess what? All of our students have to take the NAEP. They are judged by the same people who are writing this. Now, we have to get beyond the idea that the radicals are in the NEA. The radicals have taken over the testing from the federal government.
The radicals have taken over our government and written the truth of the matter be known.
Yeah, and people need to know that it's not, it's a false dichotomy to say it's the radical NEA versus the, some people will say it's No Child Left Behind, some people will say, is there to correct the radical ideology in the schools of the NEA. And exactly the opposite. These tests that are being required by the federal government are testing students on the knowledge that I have been reading to you from the national standards, and that is being required by not just No Child Left Behind, but it goes back to 1994. This is bipartisan. The Republicans can blame the Democrats, and the Democrats can blame the Republicans because they're all doing it. And it is not just, we have to get beyond the idea that we're going to correct, the federal government is going to correct what the radicals have done in the schools, because it's the same agenda.
Amen to that. Anything else you want to say, Ed?
Yes, it sounds to me like all this verbiage came out of morals and dogma.
Okay. All right, God bless. Thanks so much.
Good night. God bless
you
all. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Nathan, who's calling from Contra Costa. Nathan, question or comment?
Oh, hi. Well, I just want to take off a little bit on what the last caller said. If it was true that the Founding Fathers didn't respect the wisdom of the past, then how come we got the Seventh Amendment, which enshrined the common law?
Right, of course. So,
George Mason respected the wisdom of the past. Some of the others, maybe not so much. But it's an argument that is used to justify the implementation of the civil law.
Right. Okay.
And what we need to do is we need to get back to, we need to get under the Noahide laws, we need to get under God's laws, and we need to get back to the common law, or we're not going to really be able to defeat this insidious conspiracy, because it's a lot more insidious than a lot of people think.
Okay.
That's how it seems to me.
God bless. Thank you so much, Nathan. Okay, fine. That's Nathan calling from Contra Costa County, and if you want to get in, we're just about out of time, but we got time for another call or two if you'd like. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, and certainly I concur with all, in fact, all of our callers have been right on. I think Kurt was right on. Mike was right on. Of course, this is this evolutionary concept that we are, of course, evolving into a better form of government. Well, I don't think it's a better form. We are abandoning the tried and true system of government that has given us the freedom that we've enjoyed. And, of course, we're embracing, of course, a system that is doomed to failure because it always has failed. And, of course, what motivates this whole thing are the spiritual forces. And I know that those people who listen regularly understand that behind everything going on are spiritual forces. That's what Ed was talking about morals and dogma. Of course, why Albert Pike, who wrote Morals and Dogma, was a Satanist. And if you read it, page 321, you'll find out, of course, that the light that he worships is Lucifer. The light that really is the secret of this occult organization is Lucifer. Page 321 of Morals and Dogma. Get it, read it, understand, and help us to get out the information that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played on a political, ideological, cultural, but on an educational battlefield. And, of course, Julie and her husband and of course, the small band there, the Maple River Educational Program, a coalition that has done so much, are well aware of the spiritual implications of what's happening. And, of course, they're on the front lines of it, just as every one of you who is willing to stand up. But they've coordinated their movement, and they work together. And this is really what you need to do. That's not my job. My job is to get behind the telephone and get the information out. But somebody out there has got to take a position of leadership in every state. And then beginning, you know, you get a small band together. There are not that many people on the other side. They're just organized. And, of course, we have right and God on our side. How would you comment on that, Julie?
Well, yeah, I think that we have to, that you talked about the, you know, the progression, the evolution, in our society, and the way they're promoting this through that. I just think, quoting from the standards, they use progress and change as a means to define where we're going. So they'll say, for example, what are some constitutional rights being raised by changes in American society? Progress and change have created new issues for the Constitution, and among those are group rights, right to death, rights of resident aliens. I mean, they just put these in here as new rights that our changing society is creating, and it comes from nowhere. So if you don't have those foundational principles, you know, you have no grounding, and you can go anywhere. There's nothing to protect you from going, you know, right into the one world government that they are trying to create here.
And of course, you know, then of course the next thing they'll have is the rights of illegal aliens. And of course, I don't think that here anybody who's here illegally should have any rights at all. I mean, they ought to be deported. They aren't entitled to a hearing to find out whether they should be here or not.
Right. And they'll take you for example, they describe our Bill of Rights as negative rights. They say the Bill of Rights is sometimes called negative rights because they prevent the government from acting in certain ways. But then they talk about the social, economic, and solidarity rights, and they put solidarity rights in bold that are the United Nations Universal Declaration of Rights and that guarantee positive rights instead of preventing the government from acting. They require it to act to ensure such things as economic security, health care, clean environment for its citizens. So you can see that they're just really overt in talking about how, well, that was, you know, that was then, and now we've evolved to something positive and requiring government to do more and to really basically create an entire entitlement system for the entire country.
Well, I think that's so interesting that they would call the Bill of Rights negative rights.
That's right.
Basically, what the Bill of Rights was restricted rights of the federal government. It restricted what Congress could do.
Right.
And of course, by restricting what Congress could do, then people could be free. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or prohibiting the right of freedom of speech or freedom of the press or the right of the people to assemble in redress of their grievances. Congress shall make no law. That's what it was all about.
Right.
The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged. You see, they understand the whole idea was to limit the power of government. And what they want to do is massively expand the power of government. What they really want is an authoritarian society. What they really want is a society that Plato wrote about in the Republic 2,350 years ago. And of course, they're not going to tell the people that. And that's what they really want is a dictatorship, because they wouldn't go along with it. They wouldn't give up their freedom.
Right.
And little by little, as a thief working at night, they gradually erode our freedom. And of course, by taking the reality, the mind of our children, of why, of course, they will be the ones who will impose this dictatorship in the coming generation, or be willing to accept it. After all, it's in the name of common goods and common right. Rather than the individual, and of course it is we as individuals, we stand before the throne of judgment, not as collectively. And of course, America was founded by men who feared God. Today, men don't even know who God is.
Yeah. You know, let me give one more quote from the National Standards Textbook here. Along those lines, they say, many positive rights, on the other hand, describe certain benefits that citizens should have. These rights express the objective worthy of any just society. So while they want to pretend that, there are no absolutes, they state this as an absolute. These rights, which are the positive rights, which are the UN Declaration of Rights, are what they call objective worthy of any just society. And then they have the student do critical thinking exercises, which include examine each of the rights of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that is not protected specifically in our Constitution, and what rights, if any, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights should be established in the United States, and how should they be established. And then they ask the student to research the work that Eleanor Roosevelt did on behalf of passage of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So they are just full bore ahead pushing this as the standard, and our Declaration and Bill of Rights and our Declaration of Independence is not the standard.
And of course, what they really want is the children to embrace the United Nations and of course reject our constitutional system,
exactly,
and our Bill of Rights. And yet, of course, when they do that, of course, then the freedom that we've enjoyed will be lost and lost forever. Julie, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great
two hours,
and I've really enjoyed it. And so thank you so much. Give my best to Alan.
Okay, thank you.
Good night. Bye. All right, and fine. This is Dr. Stan. Of course, this is the time when we want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope if you'd want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters by calling 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. Tell others about our programs. Tell them about, of course, the website. Remember that book, Fed Ed, or, of course, the four-tape set, Fed Ed, and then, of course, Pray for America. Pray for revival and pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. So until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.